Welcome to this week's episode. Today we have Josh Spodek here. He teaches and coaches as an adjunct professor at NYU and has an online course that's really amazing. We dive into the course in a lot of detail, everything you can expect in today's show, but really all about how to learn from doing, not just concept. He's also a columnist for Inc.com. He has led seminars in leadership, entrepreneur, creativity, strategy, decision-making at Harvard, Columbia, Princeton, MIT. He has 5 Ivy League degrees, including a PhD in astrophysics and an MBA from Columbia. I mean, this guy's got a lot of information to share. And the best part is that he's digested it, and what he's learned is bringing this stuff out in ways that are simple and easy so that you can make changes in your life today is really his passion point. I know you're going to take out a lot of value from today's episode. So tune in. I hope you like what you hear. As always, if you have any questions, anything you want to hit me up with, send me a note. You can come over to my site, lauraco.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Joshua Spodek joining us. Hey, Joshua, how are you?
Great. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on today's show. I've been really looking forward to this episode as you are a professor at NYU studying leadership. And I just think this episode is going to be filled with so much incredible content. So I'm very excited.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I think studying part of my leadership is happening in my life, and the teaching part is what I do at the school.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, listen, before we dive in to, you know, I know you teach about experiential learning and you have so many great examples of the things we can actually do and apply in our real life. I thought you could tell us a little bit about your backstory. You're currently teaching at NYU, but you have a PhD in astrophysics and an MBA. Can you kind of give us a little backstory on how you moved from somebody who was studying astrophysics to what you're currently doing today?
Okay, I'll try to give the 2-minute version.
Sure.
If you want more, let me know at the end, because I could easily, talking about a long period of my life. But when I was an undergraduate, I loved physics. I still love physics. And at the time, it was the only thing I really wanted to learn. So when I graduated undergrad, I started grad school and got a PhD in astrophysics. And partway through, I realized that as much as I love the subject, the life of a researcher wasn't consistent with how I wanted to live my life. And I felt trapped for a while because I felt like I had to do something with my degree. And then a big, I guess, stroke of luck was that some friends of mine from undergrad approached me and said that they were getting together more for fun than anything else, but serious too, to start a business, but didn't have an idea. And they said, oh, why don't we bring Josh in? He's got ideas. And so the three of us together, I came up with this idea that we decided to do. One guy moved to Boston to get married, but the other one and I started our first business. And I really loved entrepreneurship. So the last 2 years of my PhD were the first 2 years of starting my first company. And I had no idea how much I would love it, loved it. Then in a very painful experience in the early 2000s, during a recession, is when I got squeezed out by the investors. I just didn't have a lot of business experience. And it was very difficult times post 9/11. And after a little while, decided I wanted to keep starting businesses, didn't want my lack of experience to hold me back, and decided an MBA was the best thing to do. And then in business school, I had the great discovery of learning that they taught the soft skills of business. You know, I went in to learn accounting and finances because I figured my company was losing money. I shouldn't learn about dealing with money. But in school, I realized it was much more the relationships and teamwork and things that you can't put your finger on, but turned out to be much more important. And also, to put it nicely, I was much more innocent of these things. In physics, we don't really work on these things. Mm-hmm. And so for the past 10 years, that's been my big passion, has been understanding what these things are. And the past 5 years of that has been, how do I teach that more effectively than I learned it myself?
I love that you say that, because as an entrepreneur myself, those soft skills are such a critical part of the puzzle. And, you know, most people think I've got to learn, like you said, accounting and get better at finance. But what are some examples of the soft skills that you feel have been critical in taking your leadership to the next level?
Well, I'll mention one right off the bat. This isn't a soft skill, but it's that middle step. After I was squeezed out of my own company and before business school, I worked at a friend's company. And I was hired into a position, and someone after me was hired into the same position. And not long after that, someone that we both reported to left. And so that position was open. And the other person got promoted to that position, not me. And I was really angry. And part of me was like, when I decided to go to business school, you got to get really angry. You want to tell someone off. I don't know if it was the person who promoted that person, the person who was promoted, but I was really angry. And then a couple of weeks later, I decided I'm going to apply to business school and I need a referral from someone who's manager. And that was the person who got promoted over me. And, you know, you learn the phrase, don't burn bridges.
Yeah.
And I didn't burn the bridge and I got a glowing recommendation from her. She had no idea I was all angry because I didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, I learned these relationship skills are very important. I'm sorry. I hope that was a kind of interesting story. And I hope if anyone out there is like going to burn a bridge, I recommend not burning bridges. It turned out like 2 weeks after I didn't burn it, it was valuable to have that. What made me think of it was that when she got promoted over me, I was really angry and I found fault in all these things that she did. And in business school, we started learning about leadership and management. And it turned out all the stuff, she was really an effective leader. And I went back and looked at all these things and I was like, I could have learned this from her. I could have learned this from her. I could have learned this from her. Of course it made sense that she was promoted over me. She had more experience. She had more skills. And I wish I had. So
even recognizing the skills of leadership wasn't exactly obvious. And I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. She was doing things that I was like, I would learn about later. And she was a great example. I don't have that much experience working in big corporate environments. And not actually my friend's company was a small corporate environment, but I didn't have much experience of reporting to people. And she was actually doing an effective job of managing me and leading me. I didn't know it. I was pushing against it. I was too angry.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point because I do think sometimes one can't see what they don't know until they kind of get around the corner and then they say, oh my God, now I get it, right?
Yeah, to answer your question, another example is when my first company was struggling in the early 2000s, people, you know, the employees could read the writing on the wall. It's the early 2000s, post.com, and we were not a .com, but it was still the market going down was bringing us down. And, you know, people are looking out for other jobs and things like that. And as an analytical geeky type, I looked at the tools around me, including the people around me, and looked at the resources and looked at the problem that needed to be solved. And in an abstract way, figured out a solution that if everyone did their part, we would get to the finish line and things would work out. And I did this with the other co-founder. And we figured out strategies to make things work. But then when we talk to people, you know, people, especially when the firm is not exactly doing great, they're not interested in someone telling them what to do. I treated them like tools, not like people. And it made sense to me from my perspective because that's all I knew. Abstract, looking at people in the abstract as opposed to humanely, empathetically, compassionately, what are their motivations? Not just how can I use them? And so I don't...
To get the job done, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure had I known then what I know now, I could have gotten a lot more out of them. And we would have been more of a team. It would have been me, you know, even saying it now, it's not that I would have gotten a lot more out of them. I think that together we could have come up with a solution that would have been a more effective solution than I could come up with on my own. In the process, they would feel more invested, more motivated, and, you know, they would have gotten more out of it too. I mean, they would have gotten a better deal with the company, but the company would have probably done a lot better. Of course, that's why you look for experience when you hire people and when you invest in companies.
Yeah. So the idea of pushing a company forward, trying to get things done, moving through the project list, it makes a ton of sense, except you motivate and lead through understanding compassion and recognizing where people are and figuring out how to actually inspire them. And so you've moved on into this work where you've developed all these courses to help people learn by doing. At the heart of your work, I've just been reading a lot on your site and all your blog posts, and I see you talk a lot about this idea of learning theory, right? The things we learn in school, the things we learn by reading other people's stuff versus learning through experience. Can you talk a little bit about what this means to you, what it is that you're seeing in this field?
Yeah. I mean, first, I can tell you that I took some of the top rated classes in leadership when I was in business school. And this is at Columbia. So it's like when it was top five, I forget the exact number or different ratings. And so I had really great experience. Really great classroom learning. And I'm sure that everyone who's gone into a leadership or sales context, you walk in, like say you're going to go negotiate some deal. Have you had this experience where before you walk in, you're like, I know exactly what I'm going to say. I know exactly how I'm going to handle everything that comes my way. And then you walk in and you make eye contact with the person and suddenly it's all out the window. you got butterflies in your stomach, your sweaty palms, and you don't really know what to say. And all that theory is nice, but it doesn't translate into knowing what to do or how to do it. And in my experience, I had a lot of that from school. I had a lot of what, you know, I could say I learned about leadership, but not how to lead, or I learned what to do, but not how to do it. And then over the years since then, I was able to implement a lot of this stuff, or, you know, figure out how to do these things. But I think that what I learned to do through practicing, it took as much time with the theory as it would have taken without the theory.
How do you mean it took as much time with the theory?
Okay, so you walk into do a negotiation and you flub it because you haven't done it before. And then the next time you do a little better, the next time you do a little better, the next time you do a little better. Okay, well, the first time I walked in with a lot of theory, some practice. I mean, I'm not going to say it was worthless, but say it took 5 iterations before I got really strong at it. Mm. Maybe it would have taken 6 without the theory.
Right.
Not that big of a difference.
Totally with you. I mean, I didn't get my MBA and ran a company. And I think there's certain parts that are extremely helpful in an MBA. That some of the things, and I'm a big fan of learning, but there is so much about doing. So can you give us an example of some of the exercises? So one of the things you talk about is put yourself in a low stake environment so you can practice, like you're saying. So the sweaty palm moment, I mean, people often talk about giving speeches, right? It's one of the most stressful things. And they wait till they have the speech of their lifetime to do their very first speech, right? So from what I understand about your work, you would say, don't do that. Start in a low-stake environment so that you can practice. Can you explain that in more detail?
Yeah, that's a lot of my clients. That's an issue. A lot of people, that's, you know, how do I prepare myself for giving a public, for public speaking? And advice I give, you know, it depends on every person. Every person's unique, and it depends on their background and experience and their goals. But one of the things I say is every time that you're at a dinner, take the opportunity to give a toast. Every time that friends are organizing a place to go, take the opportunity to take responsibility, to suggest the place first, or, you know, do take a lead role and assert yourself and do it on small scales. When, if you fail, it's not really failure. Like if you give a toast and you accidentally stutter, it's not, no one's going to be like, that was a disaster.
Right.
But if you do enough toasts, then when it comes time for someone to ask you to give the best man speech or the maid of honor speech, then, okay, you've done a lot of toasts. It's not that big of a jump from there. And then after you've done a couple of those, then someone asks you to give a speech that where money is on the line, and then it's not such a big deal from that point. And so what I've been doing over the past decade is I have this, you know, instead of trying to teach people, here's the answer of, you know, if someone says, how do I give a speech? Well, start with a joke. And then thank the organizers. And then, you know, that I think I find far more effective is to give someone a lot of experiences, and then they will develop those answers for themselves. So I, instead of trying to give someone the answers, I try to give people experiences so that they will discover the answers or create the answers on their own.
And one thing that I guess I would have a question, if say the public speaking, say somebody is so fearful of a new experience that really that first time is so stressful that they won't even give the toast. What do you do to encourage somebody who, even in a lower stake environment, is so self-critical that they're stuck there? Is there a way to help them move past the fear?
Well, there are a couple of things. Sometimes I work with people and we'll do a 360 feedback, and we'll look at it and we'll say, here are your strengths, here are your weaknesses. And sometimes almost everyone, they say, I want to work on my biggest weakness. I want to work on the thing that I'm lowest at. And if that's what motivates people the most, we can work on that. But sometimes you look for people with complementary skills and you just say, I'm not going to be perfect in everything. I certainly have huge weaknesses. We all do. And some of them, I'm just like, I don't want to get better at that. I know it's a weakness. I'm not going to not improve, but I'm going to make myself stronger in another area. So some people, I would say, if that's a huge thing that you don't think in your lifetime you can get over, maybe look for people who can complement you or find ways around it in other ways. So I wouldn't say you must tackle every fear in your life. On the flip side, I also often say, even if you do want to work on your biggest weakness and it's really difficult, I recommend working on something that's not as challenging, because even if you're working on something different, you're still working on how to improve yourself. And there are skills related to how to improve yourself that connect with all areas that you might want to improve in. So say it's giving speeches or public speaking is your big hurdle, and you just don't have any idea of how to approach it. Maybe also you have something that's not as big a deal for you, but maybe asserting yourself in meetings is a challenge for you, but not as big a challenge. I might say, well, let's work on asserting yourself. We'll do some exercises there. And along with learning to assert yourself, you will also learn how to stick with something that's challenging, how to work on something that takes longer than you'd like it to, how to handle things not going as planned. And now that you've gotten skilled at those personal development skills, it won't be as big a deal when you take on the bigger challenge.
Got it. So say you're working with somebody who wants to assert themselves. What kind of exercises would they start to work on? Is it different for each person, or do you have a series that you recommend?
Well, for asserting yourself, usually what I do is I work on behaviors and beliefs. So one of the beliefs is that teams work better when you have diverse inputs. And no matter how crazy or how unworthy you think your idea, it may contribute to the team having a better result than it would otherwise. And so I give this belief that partly your contribution, however crappy you might think it is, may be great. It may spur someone else to think of something differently than they would have. That's the value of diversity in team.
Got it.
Also, it gives you the experience. And I also give another big thing I say is that start off with, this may be crazy, but I feel it's my responsibility to share it. And if it's stupid, you know, say it's stupid, fine. And little phrases like that that make it easier to say. I'm sure you've heard people say these in meetings. And so that's a way to lower the barrier for yourself and also to allow people to give feedback that, you know, okay, maybe it's a crappy idea, but they're probably not going to say you're crappy for having suggested it.
Right. And I love what you said before, that teaching them how to handle, hey, that didn't go as I planned it to, right? I don't want to assert myself because I don't want to be criticized or judged. And so some resilience in things don't always go the way you anticipate, and that's okay too.
Yeah. And if I'm coaching someone and they come back and they say, I asserted myself and I went this way or went that way, then we look at the times when it works, find what worked and build on that. And also a big thing is on the emotional side is get that feeling of reward. And when it works in your favor, when you feel emotional reward, amplify that feeling, really feel it, because that's what you're going to get a lot more of as your skills improve. When things don't go your way and you feel not reward or maybe even emotional punishment, just recognize that that's part of the process. And, you know, do your best to avoid dwelling in those feelings.
Josh, isn't it amazing? Like, we will spend 90% of the time criticizing the part where we didn't do well. And when things actually work, just fly right past it.
Well, I certainly did do that before. I wouldn't put it at 90-10 now.
I didn't mean for you. I meant in general, people are so hard on themselves that they don't necessarily always recognize their strengths and when things are going well. I think that's such great advice.
I mentioned myself not to call out myself, but to say, if I can do it, anyone can, because I was really judgmental and critical as much as anyone I've ever met. And now that is a skill as well, is to be able to tune into the emotional response that you want to and crowd out the ones that don't work for you. That's this big concept for me. And I have this friend, he says, I can let go of anything. And if I feel terrible, I just let go of it. And I've never been able to let go of any emotion, especially the more powerful ones. So if I feel bad, like I feel bad, I can't just let it go. What I do find works is what I call crowding out the emotion. So if I feel really bad, it's not that I try to not feel bad. I focus on other things, and then the other things crowd out the other stuff. So that to me is a tremendous skill. I might get to the point, actually, I haven't thought about this in a while, but I might get to the point where I actually do feel I can let go of things. Not there yet.
Look, I really struggle with this myself, and you know, I call it celebrating the wins, but I put a daily habit into my life where every time I finish even the smallest of things, I just take a moment to recognize it, right? Just got it done. Great. Move on. It's not like some big arrogant festival, you know, champagne is cracking, but I think creating those habits in your life to recognize when things are going well. And then when things don't go as well, like you said, not to dwell, like to recognize it, but move on as quickly as you can. I hear about your friend and letting it go immediately. I don't know. I don't know that emotions are wrong, but I think that letting the emotional state come and go. I read that an emotional state lasts 90 seconds if we don't feed it. So, you know, let it run its course and move on.
Yeah, you know, in my course, the first unit of the course is understanding yourself. And I spend a bunch of time, I begin with a personal essay just to get people grounded, but then I get into working on perception of your senses. And then I spend several exercises in a row that work on your thoughts, starting with your inner monologue, which is something that most people haven't really paid much attention to. And when you do, it's a very rich field to find stuff in. Of, you know, the exercise, I'll explain it a little too briefly, but it's to write down exactly the words of your thoughts.
Yeah.
So to do that several times a day for about a week. And the most people at the beginning, it's they don't have a handle of it yet. They write what they're thinking about, not the actual words. And it's hard to write as fast as you think. So you start writing stuff down and then suddenly your thoughts are way ahead of your hand. And so you have to figure out how to capture a bunch of like maybe three lines worth of thoughts. And you write them. As you write them, you're thinking new thoughts, but there's no other way to do it. And everyone, every single person comes back and they're like, I'm much more negative than I expected. I'm much more judgmental than I expected. I'm much more, my thoughts are very repetitive. And, you know, all other things, you know, you get songs stuck in your head and stuff like that.
Right.
And it's this very liberating experience to find out it's not that I'm negative. The human mind is negative. It's not that I'm judgmental. The human mind is judgmental. And I find that very liberating because now you don't have to get down on yourself. You think, okay, someone walks in the room, you're like, how could she wear that? What a loser. And you think, some people think, oh, I'm such a terrible person for thinking that. I tend to think, huh, that's funny. I inherited this brain that happens to judge people when they walk in the room. You know, I have all these reasons why I think that makes sense. But, you know, I'm like, okay, my brain does that. I don't have to dwell in it. I just observe it. And then I move on from there about looking at your inner monologue to the beliefs that you hold. So at the first exercise is to write things down at the word-to-word level, and then it's more at the concept level. So people have all these beliefs, and when you recognize them, a lot of people call them mental models. I prefer belief. It's a little less jargony to me. Mm-hmm. And the more that you, just writing them down, when I first did that exercise for myself, I thought, okay, I'll write down 5 or 10 beliefs because I have some really good ones. And I did it for a week, and at the end of the week, I had something like 70, and I was writing them down faster at the end than I was at the beginning. And I realized that the point isn't just to recognize what your beliefs are, but to have the skill of observing your beliefs and recognizing how quickly they change. You know, from you have one belief in your head and then your environment changes or someone calls you up or something like that. And suddenly you're thinking a bunch of different beliefs and sometimes they're contradictory and so forth. And then it moves on to looking at other people's beliefs and how to change beliefs. And a lot of these exercises, I try to make the first ones simple enough that anyone can do them. To write down your inner monologue on a piece of paper, no one else has to see it. You don't have to tell anyone what they are. Even when you do my course online and you write, after every exercise, you write your reflections up on a forum. And you don't have to write the details of your thought patterns. And that makes it very, in my experience, no one's come back to me and said, this is not possible. I can't possibly write these things down. Some take longer than others, but they always have some discovery afterward. And then by the time you get up to observing other people's beliefs or changing your beliefs where it's more active, you've worked with these things enough time through enough different exercises that you have some dexterity with it. And your mind is able to grasp things that it couldn't before, not because you have some superhuman skills or something like that, but just because experience. Same way, I mean, a big model for me is, you know, I took acting classes in order to learn how acting was taught because I'd observed how much emotional skills in terms of observation and expression that actors had. And I don't know if you know Meisner technique, but the whole principle from this guy, Sanford Meisner, spent decades of his life developing this technique where you start with something very simple. And the next exercise is a little bit more than the first one. The next one is a little bit more than that. The next one's a little bit more than that. And next thing you know, you're behaving on stage in a way that you, a month before, you couldn't have dreamed of. And that structure, that model is what I've adopted.
And so what would be the next step? Say I write down my thoughts for a week. And like you said, there's all these different beliefs. There's 70 of them. They're contradictory. One minute I'm thinking one thing, the next the other. How do I call all of this, you know, emotional layers and trying to get to your authentic self. How do you then have your student sort through it and find themselves in all that noise?
The reflections is the main way. So doing the exercises, and by the way, you don't do them in front of the computer if you do it online. You just get the exercise. You read, this is what the exercise is, and you listen to my describing it to Chris, who's this guy who I walk through all these exercises. And then you go away for a week and you do it in your life. So it doesn't really take much time. You know, to write stuff down takes a couple minutes a day. So maybe half an hour over the course of a week. But then you have to write a reflection. And you learn by doing, and you internalize and generalize in the reflection. And it's hard to, like, I can't tell you what the experience is for others, but, well, I did all these exercises myself. And you just start learning. Like, when you do the inner monologue, you're like, I had no idea that my mind repeated itself so much. I had no idea that I would get so angry all the time. And suddenly, even if you're not trying to, it's almost impossible not to start learning how to do stuff with these newfound observations. So most of the people that do this, they start talking to others about it. Like a lot of people, like they'll bring their spouse through the course with them. And yeah, okay, there's one example of a woman who took my course, or she's still taking it, and she's 66. She recently sold a business and she's, you know, a successful businesswoman. And in the time that she was taking the course, at the very beginning, her mother at 93 needed to be put into care. And she, in her business life, had always, the student had always her way of handling difficult situations was to let things become a crisis and then order people around. And that was not going to be an effective way of doing things with the emotions running in the situation with her and her mother and then her brother and her sister. And she said that for the first time in her life, she started listening to what other people were saying and working with them ahead of time instead of waiting for the crisis to phone in. And there's no exercise in what I give that says to do that, but it was inevitable and impossible for her not to do that.
As she gained that awareness. And so you say at the core, your courses teach empathy, compassion, passion, responsibility. So as you move through this and you create the awareness of your unconscious mind that becomes conscious, you start to develop these newer skills.
Yeah, that's been my observation. And then the other thing is just to keep doing the course. Like, she stopped doing it for a while because life was so intense for her. And, you know, you can finish one exercise and start doing the next one at your schedule. So she just didn't do anything for a while. Now she's picking back up again and doing the next exercises. And she's like, okay, now I can do it. And oh my God, there's all this more stuff that I'm learning. So like, for example, this exercise that begins with inner monologue then gets to other people's beliefs, changing your beliefs. Another one that it builds to is the authentic voice exercise, which is to voice your inner monologue. And there's always this experience that I kind of enjoy when I teach this in class, you know, with in-person students. There's always this palpable feel in the room. Everyone's like, oh, people are going to think I'm horrible. If I teach my inner monologue, I got to keep that filter up. My best friends are going to find out that I sometimes hate them. And what's my mom
doing? Josh, I have a joke with my clients. I always say, if I slipped a chip in your brain while you were sleeping and recorded all the things you were thinking for 24 hours without telling you, and then played it to your friends and family, how would you feel about that?
You know,
they all go, oh my God, no.
I think it would work like this. They get really freaked out, and then they would see that their friends would be like, you think that too? Oh my God.
Exactly. That's right. Everybody's doing it. That's right. That's what nobody is realizing, that we're all walking around with this just endless noise. So, Josh, I want to ask you the questions that I ask all of the people who come on the show. What then, you've studied this, you've thought about authenticity and your authentic voice. And so what does it mean to you to have an authentic life?
To me, authentic means it's, in a word, true to yourself, but that takes more explanation. I think that it means, because if you don't know yourself very well, you can think you're being true to yourself, and society just layers so much stuff on top of you, me, everyone, that a lot of people, when you say be yourself, they're like, which self? Because everyone tells me to be a different way.
Yeah.
So I think it presupposes an awareness of your values, what brings you meaning. And that presupposes, I think, when you get down to it, it's an awareness of what emotions you feel, emotional awareness, which to me means what emotions you feel and you're feeling in the moment, and also how your emotional system works. So what makes you happy, what makes you sad, what makes you feel rewarded, what makes you feel whatever. And then to live in a way that brings about the emotions that you want, that you enjoy, that you prefer. And, you know, keeping in mind that sometimes things happen outside of your control that are going to shake that. But to live consistent with yourself, presupposing that you have a high awareness of yourself.
Yeah, I completely understand. If you can't get through the noise of all the things you've been talking about on the show, you can't find that authentic life. So getting through the obstacles of all the mind to that authentic self and living from that space.
Yeah, I had years of my life of people saying, just be yourself. And I was like, I am.
I know. I struggled so much with this. I set out to find my authentic self and I thought, you know, no problem. And it's crowded in there. But once you can kind of sort it out, it gets a lot easier. It's like strengthening.
Yeah, and also when I was younger and someone would say, be yourself, I'd go out to, I don't know, in college, I'd go out drinking with friends and I'd be like, hey, check out this thing about electrons that I know. And people are like, would walk away. You know, it's like the end of a conversation for most people is like talking about electrons. I'm like, right. I'm being myself. And the crazy thing is that now I talk about electrons as much as I ever did after, you know, a hiatus of like 10, 15 years when I wouldn't because I saw the disasters that it would do. And now I can talk about them in a way that, as far as I can tell, people find engaging. I mean, I'm doing it now. You kind of laughed. I think I didn't really like repel you with that. And I think it's more about what they mean to me and why I care about them more than just like the abstract thing itself.
Yeah, that's right. And so we talked about how your path to having a life that feels authentic. You started off with this PhD in astrophysics, move over to NYU. Was there any other real big turning point moment for you to living a life that was authentic?
There, in one sense, there are too many that I can count. In another sense, there's a couple big things that come to mind. One of them is how this recognition that other whole fields, acting was the big one that I mentioned, where people have access to this greater than anything that I'd come across in my huge amount of education. It just wasn't in the mainstream education. And so to take those acting classes was a big shift for me of recognizing that there are other ways of learning. And while an academic environment might be great for economics or history, I don't know, I'm not an economist or historian, but it's not nearly as effective as experiential learning is for leadership and entrepreneurship. So those are a couple of big things. There's another big thing that if you read my blog enough, I'm sure you came across this concept that I've called SIDCHAS, the self-imposed daily challenging healthy activity. Yeah. And I mean, you commented on how much I've written because I write every day. And that's, I don't know, maybe 50 years ago, our grandparents went to work every day and they had a structure imposed on them by getting to work by 9, leaving at 5. And most of the people in my world are much more entrepreneurial than that. We don't have structure imposed on us from without. And so I find lack of structure in my life is like running in sand or swimming in molasses. And having structure gives you a stronger platform to build on. And so having my daily exercises, my daily writing, there's a few things that I do every day. And that has led to a lot of self-awareness that is, you know, I've done these meditation retreats, for example, not helping my self-awareness, but anything you do daily that's challenging and healthy and active, really, you know, at first you're learning something new, but eventually you're learning about yourself because of that structure. I don't know if I can explain that any better than that, but I suspect you probably know what I'm saying.
Yeah, that with these less structured lives, we putting some self-imposed structure, I think this is something that entrepreneurs in particular really struggle with. You know, I create all these little habits. I get up, my son goes to school, I walk out, go to the office as if I have a job because, you know, my life will get away from me. What are some of those daily practices that you have to keep your life on track?
The first one that I ever picked up was writing my blog. So I write in my blog every day. I haven't missed a blog post. I think I'm into my sixth year now. And
oh my God, I don't know how you're doing that. That's
not long. I know that I saw 2222. So I'm at least at 2,200 posts.
Oh my God. I mean, I thought 150 or something that I've written is out there. That's amazing. But you've done over 70,000 burpees.
So that one began. It was, you know, I read this newspaper article where they asked a bunch of fitness experts, if you could pick one exercise only, what would it be to be the best single one? And one of the ones they mentioned was burpees. I never heard of it. And I just mentioned it to a friend and he said he couldn't do it. And so I said, let's do it. And we just decided, having no idea what was to come, no one ever told me you have to do burpee or you have to do a habit for X number of days and it'll stick or something like that. I just said, let's do 10 burpees a day for 30 days. And combined with the fitness experts saying that was such a great exercise and takes like a couple seconds, no equipment, no weights, I mean, there's very low risk of injury. And 10 became 11, 11 became 12. And eventually now I do 26 every morning, followed by stretches, followed by abs. Because after I do 10, you know, 11 is easy. I mean, 10 is easy, then 11 is easy. And eventually I keep adding stuff. And so then I do my crunches for the ab stuff. And then I do some pull-ups for the back. And that's a 10-minute workout that is like, I almost can't talk during it because I'm breathing so heavy or concentrating on stretching. But I do that every morning, every evening. And someone once said, well, okay, if you come home really late, you don't. It's like, oh, those are the most valuable ones.
Really? I was going to say, come on. I mean, you've eaten steak dinner, whatever your heavy dinner is. Maybe you're not, maybe you're vegetarian, but whatever it is, and you've had a couple of drinks, you're really doing 20 burpees?
Here's the biggest thing I'll do. So I have to do them in daytimes. I mean, the hardest ones I did were after the marathon, and I didn't do the burpees before the marathon. So both sets I did after the marathon. So I had to do 52 burpees. But that's why you do them is it's not superhuman. You know, it's like people say you must have a lot of discipline to do that, but it's the other way. Because I do that, then I have discipline.
Okay, so I have to ask, what's with the 100 cold showers?
A guy found my blog and then I found his and then he wrote me and then I found his. So this guy, Joel Runyon, he wrote this post on like cold shower therapy, he called it. And I'd taken cold showers mainly because I was in Shanghai one winter and it took like more than 5 minutes for the water to get warm. And I was like, I can't watch all this resources go unused. So I'd like go take a cold shower, but it warm up in the middle. And I'm looking to the posts responding to his and people are like, I did cold showers and it was the best thing I ever did. And like, people are like, I lost all this weight. I'm like, what does weight have to do with a cold shower? And so as I'm reading all these posts, at first I think, oh, that's kind of cool. I've done that. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'll do this. And then as I read more and more, I'm like, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm seriously going to do this. And then as I read more and more, I'm like, I'm going to do this soon. And then after I read a bunch, I just went over, turned on the cold water and took my first cold shower, just like right then and there. And it was a very invigorating experience. It wasn't pleasurable. It was December in New York City. And I thought, you know, I'll do it. I'll go for 30 days. And it was, you know, people who do it, get it. People who don't do it or don't want to get it, I've not been able to explain the point of it to someone who doesn't get it. But the people who do get it are like, I'll tell you this, on a day when you take a cold shower, if you're in a meeting and some blowhard is really annoying you, it's not that bad.
Right. Because you've already, what you're doing is conditioning yourself to discomfort. I knew somebody who would eat after he brushed his teeth, he would eat a lime just to like mess with himself. Cause he was like, if I can do that, you know, he had to talk to donors all day, getting rejected, begging for money for his company. And he's like, I can kind of deal with anything. So yeah, there's a little bit of getting comfortable with discomfort. I think that happens.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it's for everyone. And I know that there are people out there who are like, that guy's weird. But there are also people out there who are like, oh, I can do that too. Because I mean,
right on.
I figure there are people who look at me like I look at Joel. And for me, it's worked very well. But you know, it doesn't have to be for everyone. You know, some other changes were that the past year has been an incredible change where I joined my first CSA and a community supported agriculture where I pay for the output. Like I get 10 vegetables every week. I live on 10th Street, so I walk up to 16th Street to the drop-off point, and I pick up all these vegetables. And I never, you know, a bunch of mine, I never heard them before. I never cooked with any of them before. And my only rule was, you got to finish them all. And I was having some really horrible vegetables. I mean, great vegetables, but I was doing a terrible job with them because, you know, not all vegetables are supposed to be cooked with garlic and onions. And I was like, I don't know what to do, but I'd spent years not doing it, thinking I had to learn first. And it turns out, you know, just dive in the deep end on this one. And then I got a pressure cooker. And then now food is so good. I've never eaten so well. I've never had so much food. I'm eating more than ever, more delicious than ever. And my six pack is coming in. And it's like, it seems like that's not supposed to be possible. It's supposed to, you know, not work like that. But that's all because that was like not a daily habit, but figure out what to do with these vegetables.
Right. Well, you're eating healthy, right? Like that's the best with 26 burpees a day. I think that should start to work.
52, 26 in the morning. Now you got my nerdiness back out.
This is so awesome. Josh, I love all the detail, all the things people can start to think about every day, incorporate into their life. I definitely learned a lot. And I think for anybody who's listening, they've learned. If somebody is looking to learn more about you, read about your blog posts, check out your course, where can they find you?
So if they want to read my blog, it's joshuaspodek.com, joshuaspodek.com. And for the next week or two, which is probably before this gets released, go to joshuaspodek.com/courses to see the courses. Or if it's after that period, go to fundamentalsofhustling.com, which is where my courses are going to reside. And that page is under development right now. So that's fundamentalsofhustling.com. And then on Twitter, I think I'm at Spodek. And those are the main places to find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was a real pleasure chatting with you.
I've enjoyed it. I was looking forward to it. I'm really glad this happened.